Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Today, we're talking about firewood banks. Think food pantries, but for wood. Jay Dampier is here with us. He's the statewide horticulture outreach program manager for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Jay's expertise relates to tree care and natural resources, and also he works on economic analysis as well, and has a leadership role with the Wisconsin Master Gardener Program. So doing a lot of things. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry.
With us as well is Clarice Hard. She is a principal investigator and the director of education and outreach at the Harvard Forest. In 2016, she launched a nationwide research initiative on firewood banks by interviewing the leaders of more than 20 wood banks around the U.S. Clarice has published articles, she's taught courses, and mentored dozens of students on forest and ecology-related topics. Welcome to the show, Clarice.
Thanks so much for having me.
And as we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Perhaps you're someone who struggles to heat your home in winter. Maybe you've used a firewood bank. Love to hear from you with your questions and comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clarice, let's start with you. I sort of gave a simple explanation of fire banks, but what's entailed with it? Talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, great question. So a firewood bank, like you said, is very much like a food bank. It's a local community-based initiative, except in this case, firewood is being collected, processed, and distributed to folks who are having trouble heating their homes. Most of the time, this is on an emergency basis, but some firewood banks are able to provide a little more support to families who need it throughout the winter.
So what does it look like when you come to a firewood bank?
See, that is a great question. And it's the reason that I did so many interviews. Some colleagues, Melissa Lavangi and Sean Mahoney, and I were starting a wood bank in our little town in Massachusetts, the first one in Massachusetts. And we had ideas about what it might look like, but we wanted to learn from other people. I had heard that there were some in Maine. And so first I called some folks in Maine and I saw the differences between just a few wood banks in Maine. Some folks, some wood banks deliver to people's houses. Some folks have wood set up at the transfer station. And then I realized, you know, there are probably these things around the country. And I started looking for other search terms and you know, one thing led to another. And suddenly I was interviewing, you know, dozens of wood banks and seeing all these different ways that they work.
And so it sounds like they're locally inspired in many ways.
Exactly.
Is somebody in charge then, or is it just depends on where you are, I guess?
Someone's always in charge. It very often starts with just one person helping another person, or one church helping its own community, or a town recognizing that there is a fuel need that they're not meeting with their own funds. Yeah, and then it just grows from there. So there's always a champion. That's something that is consistent across wood banks.
And Jay, there's a fire bank here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us more about that particular bank?
Yeah, it's a group up in Burnett County. I get Burnett and Barron mixed up. Burnett County, the Interfaith, I just want to get the name here, Interfaith Caregivers. And they have a website. And they were actually one of the wood banks that Clarice originally reached out to a few years ago as part of this research study. And so they provide, it's the only wood bank I think we're aware of in Wisconsin. Is that correct, mm-hmm. Clarice? Yes. Mm-hmm. Clarice has also updated our map, and we're aware now of over 100 wood banks throughout the U.S. When the study was published, or when we were working on that, we had about 82, I believe. So, yeah, that's the only one, and they do great work. Their website shows that they've done, provided a lot of local wood to families in need.
Sandy in Green Bay is on line with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sandy. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. My son is doing a remodel job, and the old house has a bunch of these wooden slats. And it's like we're just throwing them all out. Is there some, you know, was there a use for those?
Hmm. So, you know, by wooden slats, are they timber-like or are they, is there plaster associated with them at all? Sandy?
Plaster on them.
I'm sorry?
Can
you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
Yeah, there was plaster over the slat, so there is a lot of plaster dust and some residue plaster on them, but they're all wood.
Okay.
Yeah, we would certainly say not to burn that, just because you don't know what other residues may be on that wood. You know, in our research, there was one of the interviews that Clarice did, and where a group from the wood bank was making a delivery, and they found people ripping out their cupboards and breaking them down to burn to heat their home. And this kind of tells a level of desperation that, you know, people are dealing with, but also you factor in all the health issues with burning, you know, anything beyond just pure wood. So certainly do not burn that and perhaps look into municipal recycling or municipal waste disposal for those.
And by the way, how did you, just because of your job, Jay, is that how you got involved with Clarice in this?
Yeah, well, actually, the ringleader of this project in some ways would be our friend and collaborator, Rick Harper, who's a professor at University of Massachusetts. And back then, Rick and Clarice got connected, and they started exchanging ideas. And Rick learned of some of Clarice's research in wood banks. And then as a qualitative analyst, Rick pulled me in and said, hey, Jay, here's are you interested in joining the team? And in addition to my background in natural resources and forestry, I spent about 3 years in Canada running a food pantry. I was running a food pantry. So this project really hit all the check marks for me as far as, like, you know, I have a concern for people who are dealing with poverty and difficult situations, plus also my interest in forest products and forestry, and also just using a waste product. You know, when you look at, let's say, arboricultural wood waste, wood that comes from, you know, the urban forest, oftentimes wood care companies, forest tree care companies are trying to find how to get rid of it. So you're using this waste product to help support families. So it checked all the boxes, and then I got brought into the project.
Yeah. And Clarice, this, how long has this been going on? Is there some history associated with, you know, a little history of these banks?
Yeah, this was not known until the work that I started to do. I'm most of the folks that I talked to didn't know that there were any other wood banks anywhere. So the oldest in Montana is 34 years. So many of them have been going on for a long time. But I would say the majority of them started on or after 2008 during the recession.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. Chris and Taylor has a comment for us or question. Let's go there. Chris, hi.
Yes, good morning, Larry. So I live in rural Wisconsin, still burn woods. Several years ago, it took me 41 cords to get through the winter because we have two houses and a milk house in the barn to heat. So very familiar with cutting wood. The one thing I did, I also write a weekly column for Wisconsin newspapers, and I mentioned wood banks last fall. There is a section in the bipartisan infrastructure law that actually provides grants for people to start food banks, and perhaps your guests may want to comment on that.
Yeah, Clarice, you want to...
I'm thrilled that you brought that up. so this has been kind of a result of this work, and especially a result of the work by my collaborator, Sean Mahoney, who wrote a public comment letter during the infrastructure bill, you know, public comment period. And it was Senator Joe Manchin who really kind of took this on and wanted to make sure that wood banks became part of the infrastructure bill. And so, as you said, there's, you know, $8 million in there for the next 5 years. And so the Forest Service is working with the Alliance for Green Heat to have this, to run this small granting opportunity for up to $15,000 for local wood banks to apply for support. You can get equipment. You could even order kiln-dried wood. So there's a lot of ways that you can spend the money, and the application bar is quite low because they really do want to get this money out the door to support these community initiatives that have been, you know, just kind of struggling along with a lot of volunteer labor and a lot of volunteer equipment. And these grants really build up, you know, the safety level and the reach of these. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, Jay, do you want to add to that?
Add to that. So this grant is, these grants are for existing wood banks, and they actually have a website. It's open right now. So if you happen to be an existing wood bank, you could go to firewoodbanks.org. firewoodbanks.org, and all the information is available there.
And if you're I'll probably mention this again, but if you don't have one, but you're thinking, hey, this is a good idea, I'd like to get involved, I won't be able to apply for the money, but where do they get help just in organizing one of these things?
Yeah, so there are a couple of resources. One was put together by a University of Maine professor named Jessica Leahy and her student, Sabrina Vivian, and it's called A Community Guide to Starting a Wood Bank, and that's on the resources list at firewoodbanks.org. And we also now, with some support from that Forest Service money from the infrastructure bill, some of that is going to the University of Maine to start to build a kind of community of practice around wood banks, and that will include a virtual summit that will be open to anyone who's interested. And so information for that, when it becomes available, will definitely be on firewoodbanks.org. And we'd like to do that in 2023. And so that will be for newcomers who are interested in starting their own, or folks who are looking to kind of partner up with people who have an operation similar to theirs to learn things.
And Clara Neipert, in her usual efficiency, has added these links to our Larry Mueller Show website. So if you go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry, most listeners or many listeners are familiar with that. Go to today's date and you will find those links in our program notes. So that's something we certainly like to do. In terms of where does the wood come from? Is it, I imagine it may be a combination of things, but Jay, we can start with you, and Clarice can go in and add later.
Yeah, there's a lot of diversity with wood banks and how they all operate. In some cases, they may purchase from a firewood dealer. If they're first starting out, that may be the way to get started. In some cases, it's arboricultural wood waste, so tree care companies may need to find to unload some of their, you know, excess wood that they can't dispose of. Other cases, it's the actual group, they may have access to some land, whether it's salvaging emerald ash borer or oak wilt or various other trees that would be great for firewood, maybe not good for much else. I'm probably missing a few. Clarissa, can you add any?
Sure. So just adding on to everything that Jay just said, here in Petersham, where I live in Massachusetts, it's all municipal sort of wood waste from roads after storms. Trees fall down, the highway department brings it over to the transfer station, and we come together about once a month to split it up. And then it can be given out a year later. So there has to be that lag for seasoning. There are programs through the Forest Service that called like the Wood for Life program that partners with tribes to support emergency heating for tribal elders and members using kind of fire suppression wood that's being harvested. So yeah, there definitely are many, many different mechanisms for getting the wood.
So if I had a private property and I had 25 acres of woods that I need to have thinned, I might be able to donate that, maybe even write it off.
Yeah, absolutely. Writing it off is one of the great reasons that wood banks are a real resource to landowners. So most wood banks have some kind of web presence, and they will usually have either a person you can contact or a paragraph on their webpage that talks about what kind of wood they'll accept, whether they can come get the wood or whether you need to get the wood to them.
Let's take another call. Dan in Buffalo. Wait a minute. We'll get to you in just a second. I look at the clock and I see it's time for a little reminder or two as we go along today. Clarice Hard is the principal investigator and director of education and outreach at the Harvard Forest. Jay Dampier, statewide horticulture outreach program manager for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. We'll get to Dan in Buffalo County in just a minute or two, but I want to remind you, you're also listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at firewood banks on the program today. Larry Mueller here with my two guests and experts, Clarice Hart, principal investigator and director of education and outreach at Harvard Forest, and Jay Dampier, who is outreach program manager for horticulture for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Again, questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. And now let's turn to Dan in Buffalo County. Dan, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, my question is, my father used to burn wood, and now he cannot because the insurance companies won't let him hook it up. Do you guys work with insurance companies for this problem?
All right. Insurance companies for those areas. Well, Jay, a comment from you? You're nodding.
Yeah.
Like you.
Yeah, no, when we install, insurance companies can be quite tricky, no doubt. And I'm not an expert in this, but I found when I installed my wood burner, there was a number of things we needed to do to ensure that it would be covered. So the biggest no-no is don't install a wood burner unless your insurance company knows. And you got the approval. Otherwise, you get in real big trouble if something bad should happen. Insurance companies also have various clearances, and you know, as far as like how far from the ceiling to the top of the stove, and so you have to make sure all your clearances are safe. And I had a bit of a challenge with my insurance company, but I was able to get that resolved with a bunch of photographs and showing them exactly the clearances and that sort of thing. But it certainly is a challenge in getting insured. I have to pay extra on my insurance policy for that. And that's not uncommon, that if you have a wood burner, typically your rate is going to go up a little bit.
Pat emailed us and wonders, how do wood banks handle or address issues such as EAB or other invasive issues, pests, and that sort of thing? Clarice?
That's a great question. Invasives are a big part of my research. So one of the great things about wood banks is that they are a local source, and the wood doesn't get moved beyond a town, typically, sometimes within a county, but in any case, it's very much on, wood boring insects are very much on the radar of wood bank leaders. And in some cases, this is actually a really good way of, like, for example, EAB is sort of pervasive in my county. And so within our county, we can move firewood around, but we certainly wouldn't send it elsewhere. But it's a great way to use up wood within a year.
And EAB, of course, is Emerald Ash Borer, so we should mention that in case somebody wasn't familiar with that acronym. Russ in Belleville, we'll go to you. Hi, Russ. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I just want to bring up the subject of the importance of dead wood and wildlife. I'm hoping in their best practices they consider the idea that we shouldn't just take all the dead woods in someone's to turn into firewood to save some habitat for wildlife. Frequently you see that's the first tree that people down. And, you know, it's important to keep some dead trees in the forest for our wildlife. So I hope that they have best practices that include that type of thought.
Russ, thanks for calling. I'll get comments from both of you. Clarice?
Yeah.
Sure. So I'm at Harvard Forest and I'm an ecosystem ecologist. So I'm right there with you on the importance of that. And I would say that typically, wood is not being cleared for these projects. It is downed wood that's on the, you know, on roadsides, not even like in the forest, but on roadsides. So, but that's a really good point that I will amplify with our community of practice. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Jay, any comment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And any good forest management practice, kind of to echo what Clarice is saying, you want to keep that diverse. You want to keep you know, dead snags for, you know, wood, you know, for birds and that sort of bird habitat and that sort of thing. Absolutely. Now, one critical thing, too, is also in addition to removing wood from like right of ways and that sort of thing. If it's a hazard tree, you know, if there's a target, you know, it might hit a kid or a person. When it becomes a risk, you definitely want to take that down. But I don't think that's what the caller is referring to. In a forest setting, you definitely want to maintain that diversity.
Yeah, Russ, good points. Thanks again for calling. And you can join in. Open lines at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. William emailed us and wonders, do firewood banks typically provide a supplemental amount of firewood to a household, or all the firewood they need in a season, or both? Clarice?
All the above.
All the above, Jason.
One is much more typical. The emergency use small amounts is much, much, much more typical. Almost all of them are sort of emergency use. They'll give you maybe a face cord, up to a cord, and you load it into your truck or you get it delivered, and that's your wood for filling a gap, usually between paychecks or something.
Yeah.
In our research, our lead author, Eric, we haven't mentioned him yet. And looking through the data, we found four main themes of what caused a family to access a wood bank. And one of them was emergency need. So it could be something like late season cold snap and all the wood's gone. Or maybe their budget has been used on natural gas. Often, a lot of these situations, it's a mix of fuels. And then other factors would be if they're elderly, there's medical issues in the family, or poverty. And it seems that there was more than one factor happening in almost all of those households.
Yeah.
But certainly emergency was one of the key themes in the people who accessed wood banks.
So let's talk about, there's a connection between elevated firewood burning rates and elevated poverty rates. Is there not? Jay, you both have done research on this. Let's talk about that for a minute.
So some of our work, one of the questions we had when we jumped into this was, in addition to the interview data that Clarice collected, we also want to look at some census and American Community Survey data to see, is there a relationship where wood banks are currently established in elevated poverty rates and wood burning rates, right? You would think that's kind of a reasonably decent hypothesis. Well, you know, if there are people burning wood and there's people in poverty, maybe we're going to have wood banks in those areas. And we found in some cases the answer was yes, but not always. So we've got some theories on why that might be. There's a few counties within the U.S. that have they're quite affluent. What we're theorizing is, and it's also based on some of the literature, is like, well, if you have a community that is affluent or has means to support people that have less in that community, there might be more capacity in that localized area to provide resources for under-resourced families. So we found that that was one of the patterns, but then there certainly was a pattern. Obviously, you need people who are going to burn wood and heat their homes who were in need. And so that was another pattern. So the patterns weren't as clear as we thought they might be. So that was one of the takeaways from our work.
Yeah. Clarice, go ahead.
I'll just add that I was really surprised and I learned a lot from this research, thinking about natural resources dependent areas, which tend to use firewood for home heating at higher rates. So in the state of Wisconsin, 9% of folks use firewood as their primary or secondary heating source. And here in the northeastern U.S. where I am, that number is 20%. And nationwide, it's 3%. So it's really patchy in different places. And it doesn't always necessarily only align with, where there's a lot of forest cover or where there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of really complex social and environmental dynamics going on there.
Yeah, it sounds like it. David in Chippewa Falls will give you a chance. Hi, David.
Hi. I don't know if you've addressed this, but one question is how firewood banks would deal with the issue of making sure that wood is well seasoned and dried. That's one issue. And then the other was, as I was on hold, I was wondering if any firewood banks have set up, maybe because labor is so important to making firewood, and always in short supply. If any firewood banks have set up maybe field days or something that where they could have a volunteer owner that has a wood resource. But anyway, a field day where you could maybe have volunteers cut and split and that kind of thing, and how maybe you deal with some of the liability associated with that.
Yeah. Yeah. All good questions. Clarice, we'll start with you.
Yeah. So I'll just start with the field days. So the Burnett County program has started in a way that many others start, which is to have these field days that bring in, especially sawyers, the people with the chainsaws who are trained and safe with that, those are the people in short supply. So they have these special days. They connected with a website called the Arborist Site. And, you know, a bunch of folks from all the way down in like Missouri would come up with their chainsaws and they would buck that wood. And then it could be split and stacked by volunteers and then have that year-long seasoning process. And I'm sure Jay's going to have stuff to add to that, but that monthly kind of field day model is very common and it's definitely the way to go.
Yeah. Jay, comment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you want to start a wood bank tomorrow, unless you're buying seasoned wood, it's not going to happen. You know, you need to be thinking at least a year out, and there's a lot of variables, like if we have a cool winter versus warm winter, you know, and those sort of things. And certainly when it comes to, you know, burning wood, it needs to be seasoned. So you really need it below 20% moisture. Anything higher than that, you can cause all kinds of problems. Everything from just not good heat yield to creosote buildup in a dangerous situation in your flue. So you certainly got to plan in advance. We recommend that people will do a moisture test. So you take the piece of wood, split it, and you get these little handheld moisture meters and take a few readings and just make sure that it is below 20%. Because if not, you know, it just causes all kinds of problems. So it is really critical to whether you're purchasing or, you know, letting it season for a year, doing a check in a year. Typically for most woods in Wisconsin, a year is more than enough.
Yeah.
But it's good to check.
Yeah. Clarice, can I add to that?
Yeah. Just as part of the grant program, I work closely with the Alliance for Green Heat while they're kind of operating this. Moisture meters are highly, highly encouraged in the budget. They're not very expensive, given the $15,000 range of the budget, and almost all of the applicants have requested them. So yeah, it is really important. We work with the EPA as well, who are obviously very concerned about, you know, public health and then the air, the quality of the air associated with wood bank burning. So it's definitely something on our radar. So thank you for bringing it up.
How much does one cost, roughly?
$20 to $30.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, so a homeowner who's got his or her own patch of wood can spend $20 or $30 and, you know, sort of assure themselves that the wood that they're planning to use is dry enough not to create problems. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just burns better too. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, 800-642-1234, the number to call or email to ideas@wpr.org. Anne in Milwaukee, let's go to you now. Hi, Anne.
Hi, I was wondering, you may have already mentioned it, but are there other safety resources? I know an elderly person who is heating with a glass enclosed fireplace, but she keeps kerosene starter on the mantle. She keeps the flue wide open, which I'm no expert on fireplaces, but when I was a kid, once you got the fire started, you backed off on the airflow just to keep more heat in the building and from going up the chimney. So are there some education resources available?
That's a good question, too. Jay, a comment from you first.
Yeah, the EPA has an excellent website. If you just Google EPA BurnWise, they have all kinds of information on wood burners, on safety, in interior smoke inhalation problems. So it's a really, and they also have some videos. I think they have a video on even doing moisture reading, how to properly use a moisture meter. So that'd be a good first step. And you're absolutely right. When you fire up that wood burner, you have to keep the flue open for a while to heat up that flue, because you don't want creosote buildup. And once it gets heated up, then you're right, then you start closing it up so the heat starts staying in the home more than up the chimney. But yeah, you know, yeah, there's a, within those clearances that insurance companies want, you should also have non-flammable items out of that range. Certainly, you know, even like floor protection, non-combustible rugs, which are available, and guards if you have children. There's a number of things that really need to be in place to be safe when burning wood.
Yeah, and you're nodding in agreement there, Clarice.
Yeah, and I'll just add, you know, wood banks are really wonderful community initiatives that really care about the recipients. And so they provide, in many cases, kind of this wraparound care where they're checking in and seeing, do people have smoke detectors? You know, do they know about the boiler upgrade or swap out programs that exist? And we'd like to, you know, we as the people who are kind of doing this research and building a community practice, we'd like to provide more resources to wood banks so they can do that sort of outreach with their recipients, because it's important.
Clarice, have you, sir, so have you got a loose organization here of those? I mean, you're in contact with all of them and one way or another?
Yeah, so we, some folks at the University of Massachusetts with funding from the Forest Service are going to be sending out a survey to all wood banks so that we can start to see some of the real range that exists and the over 100 wood banks that exist. And then, as I said, we're going to have this summit and start to put together these monthly kind of community of practice, really informal discussion calls. So I say we, it's a loose collective, but a very committed collective of about 12 people who really want to see this happen and have been working on it for years.
Mm. Patricia from Deerfield, Wisconsin, emailed us. She wonders how wood burning to heat homes contributes to pollution.
That's a great question, and it comes up quite a bit. So there's a few ways we can look at it. When you look at it from a carbon standpoint, you are burning a renewable resource. So in theory, you know, you take a tree down, you know, carbon sequestered, you burn it. And if you plant more trees, the idea is that, you know, it's closer to carbon neutral than burning, say, a fossil fuel like a natural gas or something like that. So there's that argument. The other argument, though, is if you're using an inefficient wood burner, you can release, you know, volatiles, you can release particulate matter, which can cause problems. The more efficient stoves burn at a higher temperature, and they'll actually burn the smoke, so the smoke doesn't go up the chimney, and those volatiles, through a process called pyrolysis, will actually burn it basically burns cleaner. Is it perfect? Certainly not. But when you burn a new modern stove at the correct temperature, with the right amount of oxygen, it tends to mitigate a lot of those environmental problems going up the smokestack.
Yeah. I think, Clarice, you mentioned you used the term natural resource dependent areas. You may have used that earlier. Exactly what does that mean?
Yeah, Jay, I don't know if you want to help me out, but it's, you know, folks who live in areas that tend to use natural resources for their immediate needs rather than going to the store to buy them.
Yeah, they're often rural communities that rely on natural resources for the livelihood of the community. So oftentimes it may be a mining community, a forestry town, perhaps commercial fishing, you know, those types of communities. They tend to be rural and they tend to be reliant, like a good portion of the local economy is based on those natural resources to keep those towns functioning.
Yeah, Clara Neipert was telling me that fuel poverty is defined as when a household spends at least 10% of their income on money for energy services. I'm wondering how prevalent is it in this country, and perhaps do we know in Wisconsin in comparison?
I don't know if I have those numbers in front of me. I don't think I do. Let me take a look. I don't think so.
Well, there's just something I thought of. I wonder just how prevalent or, you know, the need and so forth for it. And someone else wonders how do firewood banks, excuse me, compare to other solutions to fuel poverty, like modifying the house to hold the heat better?
Yeah, there are certainly local programs that you know, with energy efficiency window swap outs. I don't know if there's anything current. I haven't been up to date on that, but I know in the recent past there were municipal level programs available. If you hit a certain income threshold for your household, like if you're a lower income threshold, and you wanted to do upgrades, whether it was windows or ceiling around doors and that sort of thing, there was grants available. Unfortunately, I'm not up to date on those programs at the moment, so I don't know what's available currently.
There's recently been, I mean, this year is really a good year if you're looking to, because of new federal grants, and especially the Energy Star program, where the amount of support has is much higher for things like insulation and that sort of thing this year. So it's something for certainly for people to look at. Somebody else wonders, how does the health of trees and forests relate to firewood banks?
That's a good question and one I think about a lot. So certainly if you've got some forest health issues like invasive pests or, you know, extreme storms that are causing a lot of breaking wood, then you're going to have a lot of fuel for your wood bank. So, you know, in a certain strange way, that loss to the forest is sort of a gain to the wood bank. In a perfect world, we would just have, you know, really healthy forests and just some storms sometimes that bring down some wood, and we have enough wood for everyone. But we are in a time when there are a lot of forest health issues that are impacting forests, and those can be a resource for communities. And so that's sort of a silver lining.
Yeah. We're going to be taking a look at actually tropical forests coming up next on the show, and take a look at storms and lightning. And there's a lot of research going on right now about how trees are affected in tropical forests by lightning. And that's what we'll be coming up with next. But I'm just curious about the Harvard forest.
Oh, I'm happy to tell you about the Harvard forest.
Yeah, tell us.
So we have been here since 1907, and we are on 4,000 acres of unceded Nipmuc land, which I always point out. And we are the university's kind of outdoor lab and classroom for ecology and conservation. So pretty much any question that you have about ecosystems, how humans interact with ecosystems, how the land sustains us, these are all questions that, you know, seven scientists on site and dozens of scientists around the region and around the world are coming together on here.
Yeah. And we don't have a University of Wisconsin forest, I don't think, but we do have areas of the state where this kind of work goes on. I was thinking about northern Wisconsin, Jay.
Yeah, and we do have research facilities at a camp station, and there's various research stations throughout the state, whether it's ag-focused or forest-focused, natural resources-focused throughout the state, yes.
So you're down the road? What are you looking for, Clarice? You want to have a whole bunch more of those wood banks?
Oh, yeah. And we want them to, like I said, be a wraparound community support that's really thinking about safety, really thinking about, you know, equity issues and all of that.
Well,
it's going to happen. I hope people will join us.
Well, I tell you what, we've got on our website, on the Larry Mueller Show page, we have all the links that have been discussed today on the show. So if you want to, as you listen to our two experts, and you want to learn some more about these wood banks and maybe how you might get involved in one, or maybe how you might be able to contribute. You know, here we've got one going in Burnett County in Wisconsin. Maybe there's another county that might want to become involved. Certainly there'd be opportunities for sure. And you can learn more about all of this by going to the ideas at WPR.org/Larry and go to today's date as well. Clarice, Jay, thank you both so much. Appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have a chance to visit again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Clarice Hart is a principal investigator and the director of the Education and Outreach Program at the Harvard Forest. Jay Dampier is the statewide horticulture outreach program manager for UW's Madison's Division of Extension. And it's fun talking with them. I learned a lot, and I hope you did as well. And we're going to learn a whole lot more about tropical forests and lightning and, well, how it relates to tropical forests, but also how it might relate to us right here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.